We're at the gallery of Mary Tomas in her new gallery, and we are just so excited that you've finally gotten this thing open.
Since February,
but still, we call it brand new.
That's pretty damn new for a gallery, yeah.
He's RJ Jackson, I'm Rick Vanderslice, and we are actually in sight now of the new Mary Tomas Gallery, which is on Dragon Street, where so many of the big galleries are. I guess you obviously wanted to be on Dragon Street. Where were you before with your previous gallery? You were over on...
Dragon Street.
Yeah.
Well, it was just down the street then, wasn't it?
Yeah, that way.
Okay.
14,
it was the also gallery.
Yeah.
It's only been past, 10 years or so that Dragon Street has become the new address. It was Fairmont for so many years in that McKinney Avenue, Fairmont area, and some other places. Deep Ellum for a while there was kind of competing. Dallas, which has been calling itself or wanting to call itself, you pick which one you think is true, as an international city for a lot of years now. But Dallas now, with the population in the area approaching about 7 million, I mean, come on, we've got a big area right now. Is Dallas really coalescing into what is considered to be a pretty exciting art city now?
Well, I think so. Dragon Street definitely is heating up. We are banding together, the galleries and the other shops on Dragon Street that are making it heat up for the gallery district, and it's becoming a destination place. I think there's still a little bit of information that needs to go out to the collector people that Dallas is actually a place to come and buy art and see really good art. We have excellent artists that are local, and we always try to show local talent here at Mary Tomas Studio Gallery. When I got on Dragon Street about 5 years ago, I was with Also Gallery as the director, and Dragon Street was starting to get a claim to fame. And prior to that, I was in the Bishop Arts District, and getting that started was exciting. And now that Bishop Arts District is also another place for art, you know, people to go.
And yeah. And of course, now you have the Craig Ed Green's moved over here. Holly Johnson's moved over here. Gerald Peters, where did they go?
Well, Gerald Peters decided to move. He kept his location in California and Santa Fe, I believe, or actually maybe it's Santa Fe and New York. But I think it just got to be when he moved from the other area that he was over on Fairmont, it just became like too large, now we've got all kinds of. It's a very eclectic mix. It's an exciting eclectic mix. It's where art and design merge, and it's just there's so much energy that's happening down here. It's excellent. It's the best street.
No,
to
this used to be such more of a dead area. I mean, I remember I used to work over. There's a catering company in the design district, and that there's like a plaza just nearby. And I remember being taken to and from work, and how dead it was, and how few people you'd see walking the streets. It wasn't very pedestrian friendly, and it was it was like a no man's land. I wondered how anybody sold anything.
Right.
But I mean, the thing is, speaking of, I mean, I still don't quite understand how having an art gallery even exists. I don't understand how the revenue works or how one stays afloat, how it is more, how it can be a business as opposed to somebody's baby and, something that they invest in because they want to keep, just because they want to have an art gallery. And this is your studio as well as your art gallery.
Right. That's a really, really good question because I'm still wondering the same thing.
what a time to be wondering.
No kidding. I opened my gallery just in time for the economy to go bust, but... The thing is that if we could just go back just a wee bit, I have been in the illustration and graphic design business for, I started at Art Institute of Pittsburgh, and that's been my career. And I've always been interested in expressing myself through my art. And about 1998, I took a leap of faith to just concentrate on my fine arts. And the reason why I did that is because I read this book, A Year to Live. And when I read this book, it just empowered me to really take that leap because it was something I was very passionate about. So back to your question, mm-hmm. is that my passion really drives the sense of of my business, and my business sense sometimes is done purely from the gut and from the heart. And when it comes to, you know, bean counting and things like that, you know, I'm still way on the learning curve. But this is what I do, and this is what I am, and this is all I know how to do. I'm 55, I can't go into nursing or, you know, something like that.
And you never know, you might only have a year to live, Mary.
Right. And so I'm going to go down with flying colors. So that's how really I got started. And it just, since I have a passion for what I do, a passion for my own art and a passion for other artists, I can talk about it easily, and I find that good art with the right person will sell itself. And so I've been fortunate in the sense that I've been able to make a living. Now, in the gallery business, it is nice to have like a sugar daddy or, you know, somebody fronting you some money, because sometimes, like, when the economy gets, you know, lagging like it is now, it would be nice to have, like, a little, you know, honey hole to go back into and...
Just like a billionaire's or a foundation,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, so I'm really on the lookout for, what do you call those persons that... just want to give you fork over some cash.
A benefactor.
Yes, I'm on the lookout. I'm on the lookout for a benefactor that believes in what we're doing here at Mary Tomas Studio Gallery.
What makes a good art city, an art center? Does it take universities? Dallas isn't really known for universities. What is it? Why is New York a big center for art, or why is London a big center for art? What do you think makes that work for a city?
I think what makes it work is that let's take New York, for example. They embrace their multicultural aspects of the city. They didn't look at things in a conservative way. I mean, you could basically see so many different types of art, different types of things. They weren't opposed to going out and thinking outside of the box. And I think for Dallas, that's the learning curve that I see for Dallas, is that I've always felt that Dallas is a little bit of like, you're carrying the latest bag, everybody's going to carry that latest bag. Even though it's a maverick city, in maybe architecture or things like that. But in the arts, I think what it takes is the belief of the collectors that you can actually find good art here. And so, you know, that trickle-down economics where the collectors believe in the artists, and then they, you know, it goes both ways. Then more new art starts generating. And so I think that's the exciting thing about it right now, is that people are getting the message that, wow, there's really a lot of really good stuff here, and it deserves to be looked at and collected and things like that.
So what about supporters or collectors? Does the same criteria operate as far as the city being a draw for those kind of people? Dallas is a big entrepreneur town. People can make money in a hurry here. Mm-hmm. It's always been known for that.
Yeah, Maverick City.
You have a lot of the nouveau riche, and you have a lot of established money here.
They call it old money.
Yeah.
Old money. But, I mean, some older...
And there is a hell of a lot of it in Dallas.
Some older towns are not known for having people who are going to invest in art, and others do. There's actually a lot of art collection in Las Vegas, a very new town, mm-hmm. and you've got a lot of moneyed people who do collect, and their museum is actually quite a good one there, believe it or not, because I saw it recently. But Dallas collectors and all, where would you put them? Is there a good... good group of them that's really doing some exciting things?
Well, there's different kinds, aren't there?
Yeah, they're definitely on different levels. I mean, on the one hand, we've got the bigger money that is very generous, I would say. The whole arts district downtown is a perfect example of money that is and people that have generated a lot of money for that wonderful thing. One of the pitfalls I see of the Arts District is that it doesn't allow for the spaces. It doesn't provide the space for the younger artist or the artist that is not in that same kind of upper echelon.
There is an establishment in the city, is there? I mean, I think that there are different art crowds. I mean, you have sort of an established, an older crowd, and then you have sort of a younger, more upstart crowd. It's weird. Like, I guess on the negative side for the people that are of the wealthiest and the ones that have, like, just gobs of money to invest in artwork is that they're going to tend to go for the safer artwork. They're not going to go for anything as bombastic. The people who are sort of newly acquired to art or just don't really understand it but have the money to buy it are going to buy a lot of just the awful crap, even though it's taking chances. It is awful crap, but it is just because due to their, I don't know, lack of insight or ability to tell one good piece from a bad one.
Exactly. Well, I still think that there is the perception here that, you know, if you see like a Warhol on the wall, well, all of a sudden your status is elevated.
But it kind of is.
Yeah,
It's really, every time I see a Warhol, every time I go into a house and I see a Warhol, I'm like, that's really, it's nice. I mean, I'm not impressed with them personally. It's not like, I don't want to walk up to them and shake their hand because it's a pretty safe bet, you know.
Well,
that's a pretty good brand.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes those cues are what make art exciting for, let's say, a bigger audience than maybe the art crowd itself. It's because of maybe Warhol's eccentricities and his lifestyle and his PR during his lifetime and all, and just the really avant-garde-ness and starkness of the point he was trying to make put some cachet to it, but it's still the art. If you had come from Mars and you'd seen the soup cans, would it have registered the same way? I mean, part of that
it
is the celebrity.
It probably would have looked like advertising. You need to have the proper context to look at it. You'd have to have a past experience with just ordinary sights. And, of course, I mean, it'd probably be different if they were to sort of respond to something that you had made. So you're a little bit more of a naturalist than Andy Warhol. I mean, I think that there would be a little bit more recognizability. It would be immediately recognized.
Though they both started out in design. Andy Warhol was a designer and a fashion designer.
I believe he was an illustrator.
Fashion illustrator.
Which does have, I mean, of course, when you talked about how you set off on your own, I mean, so there was sort of a standard that was set for you. You had to follow certain parameters. Did you pursue this because you wanted to just completely free fall it?
I did. Yeah, I just wanted to completely just come right out and just do something that was totally an inward. Because with illustration, you're basically oftentimes being the hand for somebody else's idea.
You have to interpret somebody's idea.
Well, I mean, you're pretty much told what to illustrate.
Right.
I mean, it might be with your own particular style.
Sure.
But you're from the beginning, there is a set an obligation.
Tell us about the Art Institute then. When you knew, well, did you always know you were going to be an artist?
Yes, I did.
I mean, as a kid, you knew. You were drawing Crayolas and all that kind of stuff?
When I was five and I went to nursery school, they gave me Play-Doh and finger paint, and I thought, man, this is
you were in hog heaven.
And
you just knew.
That was it.
So you went to well, it's a pretty good school, the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, and I'm sure there's a lot of talent there. When you first got there, how often did you have to adjust to what you thought you were going to be doing?
I took right to it.
You took right to
actually,
it.
Actually, it was just something I enjoyed doing, and I had high school training in the arts, and it was just something I took right to. And I
enjoyed the multimedia.
I was an A student, and it was wonderful to be an A student because as a student, I really wasn't like an A student. I was more interested in boys and talking in class and things like that.
Granted.
Yeah. So, and not really, you know, always on the report card. It was, she'd be great if she just apply herself, you know. Yeah.
Where have I heard that?
Yeah. So I'm sure a lot of artists, and plus I'm a visual learner, and a lot of the other things that, you know, just didn't sit well with me.
But you enjoyed all kinds of expression. Did you get into the sculpture classes and do that? And you did some of the ceramics, and you did mosaics and you did it just
no I was really
collages
just
and all those kind of when I was in art school I toyed around with all the kinds of things, and some things I responded to and some things I didn't. I took to oil and I took to pen and ink. For some reason I had the courage to do pen and ink, not pencil and ink. Is that the Leo in me? I don't know.
You know, you work very much in the ethereal hues, very soft colors, soft shades. I mean, is there any particular message you try to convey? Do you ever do anything like, is there something political somewhere behind it, or is there something, is there a grand message, or is it just this appreciation of beauty or an appreciation of the world, or how, you know, I'm never able to be sure what kind of message somebody's trying to express in their artwork.
There definitely is a message. One thing I wanted to say about the collage and all that was that I'm a visual observer, so my visual observation comes through in whatever I'm using. However, most of my medium has been in watercolor or pen and ink or Japanese brushstroke and things like that. But my belief, my inner core belief, is that we are spiritually tied to nature. So I do, my pieces are metaphorically indicative of my belief that we are all interrelated in, and so, and very layered as human beings and characters, and that we have an intrinsic tie to our spiritual, physical, and mental life. And so when I'm observing nature or painting it, I'm not only painting a landscape, I'm actually saying something metaphorically on how I feel about being a visual observer, being in a place and capturing that view. But I am also very very intent on capturing this sort of spiritual feeling that I feel when I respond to nature.
So is it premeditative or does it happen naturally?
It
so
happens
to speak?
Naturally, but in all of my work I have the presence of light and dark, which I think is back to my spiritual side, that we have those forces in ourselves that are at play all the time. And so often my work, well, I would say in most cases my work, you'll see the light and you'll see the evidence of darkness, and or layers or intricate intersections of color or line and shape behind. And because back to that whole layering concept, I believe that we as individuals, you know, you see somebody from the outward view, and then as you start to know them, you become it's just a much more layered experience where you start knowing a person, and there's just layers and layers of stuff.
So you know you're done cover. When you've properly familiarized yourself enough with it to introduce it to others, I suppose.
Well, I know I'm done with it when I feel that it, when a painting to me just has enough layering and enough, when I feel like I've captured some sort of ethereal moment or something like that.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You are, of course, expressing your motivations, your inclinations as you're creating art. You're following your bliss and what you see and what you feel. But eventually someone's going to own that piece of art. It's going to leave you. And it's going to hang somewhere. And you obviously have ideas or hopes about it after that. Obviously, a piece of art hanging on a wall in someone's home or office or foyer, every time you see it, you're going to be different, the day is going to be different, and what you could get from it could be different as well. I mean, it's not just a static thing that just remains in one place.
It can be, but I mean, if mistreated, it can be.
It's not a static thing. It's interesting. I mean, that's a good question because, like, for example, I have a collector who probably has about like 8 of my pieces, and when you go into her house, you see all of this work of mine over the years that she's bought, and the one thing that you are struck by, or that I'm struck by when I see a piece again, is just this sort of, not lonely, but it is, most of the pieces are capturing a moment that is sort of just a visual observation of a moment that takes place that gives the viewer, a place to put themselves in that moment or not. Just if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at something in like the pieces that are out here that you might see.
Mm-hmm. Well, to describe it, we're looking at a piece right now on one of your easels that you've brought close. This is radio, so here we go. but in a black frame, you've got a highly rectangle framing of a piece that has contrast in light and dark. There, it's not a sharp line, but it is evocative of light, maybe emotion, certainly expectation. It's got all of these things that you can fill in or react to and identify as you feel it, right?
Mm-hmm.
This piece seems to do that for me.
Right. I mean, it could be a morning, it could be an afternoon. It doesn't matter whether it's morning or afternoon or whether it's a drive, whether it's a sunset, but you can place yourself in that, but it may not be indicative of like a family vacation. You know, like you might be driving and it might be a drive that you drove by yourself. And it might be that moment when the earth and sky capture this feeling of that sort of transcends you from you know what you are doing at the moment, and that is what I would say if there was one thread that I could say would capture that, it would be that. And likewise on the painting below,
you've got clouds of some kind, or at least that's the first thing that I saw, but you know, you could be real creative and say it could be an iceberg too. but there it is. It's billowy, it's white. The contrast is really interesting, and it makes you go to the edges and find where it interacts with the dark or the darkness or the dimension. And there is dimension in that, the way you've framed it, which is also interesting. You can really see the three-dimensionalness of that.
Mm.
But it does evoke an emotional response for me. I identify with it without knowing what inspired you to do it. That's curious to me. There's a universality going on.
Well, I mean,
there.
Thankfully it is successful because it's a very easy thing to get wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do become vague enough, then at that point it becomes evasive. I mean, not just this. I mean, I see a lot of artwork where people that try to do the same thing that you do. Not the exact same thing, but I think they try to go for the same thing. They leave so much open to interpretation that it doesn't really become owned by them, or it's not their individual work, because they're leaving so much up to chance, they're leaving so much up to their audience, that it becomes sort of, I don't know, it becomes stock.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, thankfully you're able to accomplish this. I mean, I've always liked your work. I've always been very fond of it. And
well, describe the big piece you're looking at right now. Again, our listeners cannot see this, but this is my favorite piece. This huge,
oh, the one behind you, the one behind
that's
you.
That's right.
This landscape, you know, roughly about 9 feet in width, 2 feet in height, more than 9 feet, maybe 10. Or 11. I don't get my feet right sometimes.
Yeah, it's about that.
But it looks rather like a daytime sky with trees or shrubbery. To the right is a sort of red area, a reddish area. I don't know, evocative of flowers or of a tree, mm-hmm. Or a shrub. But I mean, it's there, and it really does. It gives you what you need, for sure.
To me, it's familiar. But it's also lovely, and loveliness isn't always familiar, but for this it is. And I think the adding the bit of color there on the right to really contrast it, or just, I don't know, give it possibilities, and the way you've framed with some of the shadow on the ends, but especially like the clouds. I love what you do with clouds. As a kid, when you were driving on family trips, did you? I know I was that way. I just looked at the clouds.
Looking at the clouds, yeah. I
and
spent
seeing
a lot of
stuff,
time.
And just being in awe.
Yeah, I just love. Well, I love the beauty of the Texas landscape. I really do. I love.
We have great skies here.
We do. We have great skies and the expansive drives. I get a lot of. I get a lot of inspiration from
that. Is
this
a Texas scene?
It is. It is a Texas scene. Driving out on 67 toward the southwest sector of Dallas, which is
beautiful. But no place in particular. I mean, it's just sort of a culmination.
No, it is a culmination because it's just that new spring with the you know, the redbud trees and the sky. It's just something that always captures my attention.
Why do you like the rectangular?
I like that long...
Well, the panorama?
The panorama is such a nice...
Because I believe that, you know, my pieces are about relationship. My pieces are about relationship to man, to the God of their understanding, to other people, and so...
To the God of their understanding. What an interesting line.
Thank you. Well, I didn't actually make that up.
What is that? Tell us about that.
Well, but let me finish about the long landscape.
Sure.
The landscape, to me, it just kind of invites you in, and it because it's long and narrow, it causes, it's restful. It's it's lying down. It's horizontal, and so you feel this sort of peaceful, restful feeling.
Yeah, the tall and narrow doesn't tend to encompass very well.
Yeah, so. But I do like tall and narrow too, because I love that sort of awe-inspiring kind of upward, you know, piece, like out there, the trees that go all the way up. So I do a lot of linear type of work. But back to the God of my understanding, I like that because not everybody understands God in the same way, and I think that it's important to have a dialogue between all walks of faith or spiritual lives so that we can find our common ground, and, you know.
Is that what art is about in the final analysis? Is it that transcending kind of vehicle, or can it be that?
I think it can be. I mean, you know, it's definitely different for everybody. I think art is a form of definitely self-expression, and some of us are expressing beauty and peace, and some of us are expressing excitement or anxiety or control, or, you know, it's just about what you want to express.
Or a form of worship.
Yeah, it could be. I wanted to go back one tiny minute to Warhol, yeah, because you said something, Rick, that made me, that reminded me of the fact that I think that a viewer, I hope that when somebody buys a piece of art, that they're not just buying it for the signature, that they are buying it because they want to key in to that artist mentality, and Warhol definitely, you know, really set the art world on fire with his new ways of thinking and looking at art. And so, you know, if you have it for that reason, I think it's wonderful. And that's one thing that as a galleryist or gallerist or whatever, as somebody who is also representing other people's work, This happens to be a little bit of the struggle, because I have my own collectors, and my collectors may have like four or five of my pieces, or three, or whatever. But right now I'm on the hunt for how do I transcend out of my collector base, which has been very, very good to me. How do I get new collectors to understand what I'm doing? And how do I get them to understand why I have these other artists mm-hmm. in here?
And how do you do that?
Don't know. I mean, you know,
this is what you're about now.
You know, it's kind of like I feel like, well, when I have the gallery, I'm just like throwing, like, you know, the spit wads on the wall to see, okay, is this going to stick? Is that going to stick? Because basically, and I'm finding out, and sometimes it's a frustration that when you are a gallery, all of a sudden you become this magnet for every artist. You know, when you have a show, you walk in, people walk in, and you want them to be buying your art so you can play the game, so you can, you know, make new art, and you can pay your bills and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like 19 million people walk in here and they go, oh yeah, I'm an artist, and you're like, well, you just want to shoot them, because, you know, it's like, whoa, is everybody an artist? Where are the collectors? Yeah, yeah, well, that's what we need. We need people, the trickle-down economics.
Maybe they want you to hang some of their art for them.
They do. Of course they do.
RJ and I had a program one time where we talked about what is art and can anybody be an artist? I'll throw it out there. Can they?
No.
I think anybody can use the artistic medias to make a piece of art and call it art.
I support that, actually. Yeah. She's right. Anybody can do the...
But it's not up to them to decide their success?
It's not a matter of it. It's a matter of a community to decide
its
success.
It's tricky, isn't
it? It's very tricky.
It is very tricky.
Well, it's tricky, but, I mean, it leans in certain directions more than others.
Many good artists have... several of the greats.
Van Gogh is the
great example. They were
never recognized.
Yes, he was, because we're saying his name.
Well,
but in his lifetime, he wasn't understood. Yes, he was not.
Why is it that artists have to... you know, schlep their wares. I mean, you know, you'll have a person come in here and they'll expect you to give them a deal. It's like, I mean, you know, the plumber doesn't come and you say, well, you know, can I get 20%?
If anything, you get conned out of more money than you were supposed to pay. I mean, if there was an opportunity for artists to haggle up.
How do you do that? I know from my days in art school, and I did not pursue it. I went into broadcasting. Some might call that an art. Most don't. But we had classes, and we had artists talk to us, and we did cover a bit of the business aspect. And how do you build a career to where you can understand how you can price, how you can change that pricing as you progress? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
In other words, how do you fluctuate and react and exist within the business world that treats art as a commodity, as well as you being the artist who is involved in an aesthetic?
It is very tricky. It is very tricky. I mean, you know, an artist is really maybe not super wired in that fashion. You know, I mean, to be an artist is somebody who's really in touch with their emotions, and they may not be like a really good mathematician, for instance, or they might not be quick on their feet when it comes to talking. They might even be shy or whatever, but it's definitely a learning curve, and it's definitely something that needs to be talked about more. I mean, every artist should have a business class, and I mean, in our schools, we cover history, but we don't cover, you know, how to budget and finance, and, you know, it's nutty.
Because that doesn't make you famous,
right?
Unfortunately,
right. And fame is the elusive butterfly. Because I mean, you can be a wonderful, fabulous artist, and if you're not seen by the right person at the right time, I mean, it's pretty much it can be like a crapshoot, I guess, or you know.
Well, but I mean, I guess that, I mean, that might be why people try to come in here and get deals from you and such nonsense. It's just that's the way that they see art to be. I mean, they see it as fun. Mm-hmm. It's something determined by popularity. It's something determined by fancifulness. It's not taken seriously in a general way. I think people, I mean, especially people that aren't loaded or don't have money, just stuffed to the gills with money. Of course, I mean, there is actually, when they do the first Thursday of every month, there is a really good crowd of people.
There is.
But
serious
thankfully,
people.
I mean, do you think that because of the economic crisis, people are actually coming out more and they're realizing. I think a big problem that we have is that people who are just of the middle or lower classes don't realize that it is actually open to them and available to them. Mm-hmm. And
we're trying to get past that with our Dragon Street Association. We're trying to, you know, answer those questions for people. But it is interesting because, you know, especially when somebody comes into a gallery, you're not quite certain. Do they want to be left alone? Would they like more information? You don't want to scare people off. It's a real interesting
dance. Do they know that you're the person that's painted it?
Yeah, and sometimes that's not a good thing either. You know, I mean, I've had a serious collector looking at my work, and then he asked me about the artist, and I said, well, I'm it. And, you know, all of a sudden it was like I threw a bucket of ice water on him, you know. To me, it would be good to see the artist and you know, ask them questions. But that's not always the case.
You know, maybe
everybody.
You could just lie and you could say, yeah. like, he's not in. And,
right,
and you
exactly.
could say, you know,
yeah,
he's,
yeah.
He's in his
well,
smoking
jacket. Well, I
tried
to do that. I tried
to the fireplace
do
at his
Yeah,
at his
I tried to do that. I had done an abstract, and this collector of mine came in, and she loved it.
Oh, no,
and
yeah.
And I said it was by an unknown artist, and I could not. I could not, in all honesty, you know, go, oh, yeah, well, you know.
They're dead and anonymous
what about,
or something.
Oh, what about criticism, which... It just is part of the art world. It's part of my world in broadcasting. It's mm-hmm. part of the world in anything that's out there in the public. And some of it is very good and some of it isn't.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is, but you have to deal with that. How do you adjust to the built-in possible disappointments that they weren't listening or they weren't viewing correctly or they were drunk that night and weren't paying attention.
Or that an unreliable idiot was given an article to you know, to review other people's artwork. I mean, that's actually one of the worst challenges of all. Because you see a lot of art critics, they have a very hard time. A lot of times they don't want to be jerks.
Right.
And they want to sound like they know what the hell they're talking about, which when you're dealing with a medium like this, especially considering your artwork, which isn't stark, it's not working in, you know, there's no Mickey Mouse in the middle of it, or as the soup cans that y'all mentioned earlier. There's nothing immediately, like take for instance a gallery down the road, and you always notice like a lot of Latin artists love to like just stick the Virgin Mary in the middle of stuff. You know, or just a lot of religious things, maybe saints or,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the
yeah.
sun.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just things that are really obvious, however good it looks, however well the technique or the craft of it is. I mean, there is usually things that people go for when they can't quite consider an idea. I mean, and that's pretty precarious of what you do because it's not trying to go for something immediately recognizable to the point. I mean, you have other artwork here where there is something and you know what it is.
Right. Right.
But I mean, I usually hate a lot of the artwork where people seem like they're just trying to get away with murder is usually what I say. But I also, I mean, I appreciate people that aren't going for the obvious. But I forgot how we even got on this. What were we talking about?
We never know how we get on it. That was an interesting point. Let me follow up on something here. We're more and more in this virtual age. Even you have a very nice presence on the Internet with your site. I know Alberto's helped you with that, and you all really have a nice, classy look and all. But
thank you.
But this the newer generations coming up are... Are they going to be, will it be obvious for them to want to buy brick and mortar art, or are we going to have a more virtual experience to where it's in pixels? And
I mean, it does seem to be coming down the pike, and but I don't know, I still am a firm believer that no matter how far down the road we get in the technological areas, that we will always have the need for that tactile experience that is only things on paper.
I'm pulling for you.
Yeah.
I want to believe that, and I hope
no,
that's
true.
No,
it's true.
It is true.
You're confident
you
of that,
to.
Too?
Do you
want to
read
to.
A book online? Do you want to sit there and read a book online? Do you want to strain yourself with that nonsense?
No, but we're of this age now where we're going
to. Do you want to have to
change.
Have, like, if your electricity goes out, what the hell do you do?
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
If your internet connection is down, what the hell?
I think there will be a movement. I do. You know, kind of like the slow food movement. I do think that there will be a movement where
the what movement?
Slow food movement. What's where
you take time to cook your food or
you take time
more.
To
it's
grow
not the thing,
it.
Yeah, it's
it
not the thing where you like chew it 50 times or something like the Buddhist.
Well, sort of. I mean, that takes time
well, that
too.
That helps too. That but no,
that's
you,
pretty
that
tedious.
Slows
you
it
actually,
down.
You
I really, if you've got the time,
right.
Good for you.
You actually are growing your food and eating what you grow.
Oh,
and
yeah.
then, or only buying what's local, or that's what they call the slow food movement. But I do, you know, I mean, like if the electricity went out and all you had is you know, like art on pixels on your wall, that'd be pretty sad. I mean, when you go into a house and you see a lot of artwork that has been purchased in your travels or by other artists, it just makes the house so much more interesting and eclectic. It just goes without saying. I mean, you go into a house that's just got all the designer accoutrements and everything, it just looks like something out of a box.
Well, you know, it's an art in itself, isn't it? I mean, the collector is an artist.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You mean the arrangements in art?
Well, but I mean all of it. I honestly believe that a good collector, Raymond Nassar, was an artist.
Absolutely.
In his own right, it's another form of art.
We
as the collector
it.
Of yeah. great works of sculpture, and he collected Moore, and he collected Giamatti and everybody else, and now has a museum dedicated.
No, you could consider
his
the gardens
collection.
A work of art. I mean,
oh, but how interesting that I mean, it all you can basically follow his travels throughout his
exactly.
life with the different things that he's bought at different times, and what
and that's
a
what he told me
gift.
In the interviews that I've done. I've done a couple over the years. Before, of course, he's since died. But a really accessible man.
Mm-hmm.
But he and his wife, Nancy, both travel the world, and they if they saw something, it wasn't necessarily maybe an established person or whatever, but they saw something, and they said, we must have this. This is good. And soon enough, they became established just by their collecting, maybe. But it wasn't because they were established, it was because he was satisfying his taste. She was satisfying her eye.
Mm-hmm.
It was doing something for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way they would you know, display it out, not only in their home, but out on their lawns and else, they made it a part of their landscape.
Right,
their
right.
life.
And that's the perfect word for that, because it's like the landscape of your journey is a wonderful metaphorical thing that you can you've gone here, you've been there, you've done this, you've done that, you've interacted with this artist and that, and it just that's an interesting.
And what an odd relationship. I mean, you were talking earlier about going into somebody's home that has like 5-6 you know works of your artwork all from different periods and you know parts of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, and that must be sort of the same experience, except I don't know. That's just a strange symbiosis. But as far as people being able to, you know, just respond to it in just a very general way. When I lost my train of thought, I was talking earlier about when you know you have art critics and what they're trying to do is convey and translate.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, it's just a very difficult thing to do.
It is,
and it's a difficult thing to know how to do well. Now you could make stock artwork. Now you've gone into places where they have the artwork and it's all in those really ornate gold embossed
mm-hmm.
frames and just really. It looks like it is from a set time. There is kind of, there is artwork that is at this point rather passé. And of course with the fear that you're talking about and the internet age and all of that, which I think is ultimately going to be nonsense.
But what she's about
it's not
you're about.
Die.
You tell us what you're about.
It's
but,
not going to conquer the art world is what I mean.
I know in some of the stuff written about what your art tries to evoke is serenity in a way. You want people to meditate. You want people to slow down and
mm-hmm.
drink it in
absolutely.
At their pace.
Yeah.
Which is the antithesis, again, to the modern age we have right now, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm pulling for you. This is
thank
what
you.
I want. Well, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
here we
that's
are.
What I
we're
think
so
too.
Busy now.
Yeah,
and
we're
wanna,
busy
like,
texting and.
You ever
know,
watch
the
how
immediate.
People on the internet will watch, let's say there's a news event or something, and then they'll have the picture, and you can hit all the dots and go through all of the events, and they'll have
yeah,
the pictures come
bites.
Up.
Yeah.
And it's just fast, fast, fast.
Yeah.
It's a smorgasbord table. It's,
because they don't care
buffet.
About it as much. I mean, they're going to want to go.
They don't know.
They don't know to care.
Right. I mean,
don't you think that's...
And people are just worn to a frazzle.
I mean, and this is why you have branched out, not just as an artist, but you're actually in the gallery business because... You're wanting to teach as well as offer art. Am I right?
Yes,
is that too?
Yeah.
Is that too?
No, I would
academic.
Say, no, I would say that that's true. I would say that that's
so.
True.
What would you like to teach? I mean, what aspect of the teaching
to stop
can
and
this
smell
do?
The flowers? To stop and
it's that simple.
To stop and view beauty or view somebody else's interpretation or view their emotion or. Because everything in here really is, like, for instance, the marble works, that is something that's tied to history.
And who is this?
This is Adriana Coppo-Frankel. She does...
There's several pieces you have here. They're
marble.
Just lovely. Some is the white marble, and some is the
travertine
over here.
And that marble comes from the same marble... area that Michelangelo got his marble from. So there's
in Tuscany. That
there's a link to history, and you know there's something about the marble that you know it's not going to be done in a day. It's a very long, kind of tedious process. And so
God, it must be awful. I mean, it's rewarding. No, it's great. It's wonderful to look at. But I just
yeah. And so like and with
you're showing your generation here.
What?
Something long and tedious.
You're impatient, long and tedious.
No, but it's still a beautiful thing to behold. Well, I mean, doesn't that make somebody who manages to make a marble sculpture all the more impressive?
Yeah. Would you have jobbed out the Sistine Chapel? we just wouldn't have had time for it.
We need... how long did that take?
Like a year?
What can I say? When you approach a piece that you're going to do, obviously there's an idea.
Uh-huh.
Take it from there.
Well, I always work in a series because I have a train of thought, a thread that I follow. This series that I have up is just a little lighter in color and tone. I was intrigued by the hot pink of the spring colors. So, but I always work in a series. I'm getting ready to do a series on an antique dress of my grandmother's, and I'm going to explore a few things. It's also nature. It's always important to me in my work, so I will use nature in that. But I always come up with a series of, I follow a train of thought, and it has to do with history and the visual observation of my surroundings.
And is it one, even though a series is involved, is it one piece at a time, or are you doing subsequent work on all as you
go? I usually work on several pieces at a time because of the layering that's involved.
But you do a sketch out first. No, you don't.
No, it's
that way. You keep that line very ephemeral.
The way I start a painting, and the way I think is a very important way to start an oil painting, and this is the way I would teach, and I'm also giving classes where I do teach oil painting.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I enjoy layering, and I start out every painting I do with deep reds and browns, like the old masters did. And the reason why I do that is because, to me, that is the bones and the blood of the painting. And then, through a series of layering, and I mean, I could do a complete white painting, and I have done several white paintings, and they all have, they have all started off with the Chinese red, burnt umbers, the deeper hues.
Even though they might not be visible.
Phthalos. Oh, yeah. But they are visible. Because when you see an oil painting that has underpainting, a lot of underpainting, you can feel the heat. You can feel that there is a structure behind it. And it's something that many people have commented on, but they don't even know why it is that they're... what it is they're actually seeing, because they're not actually seeing that particular color. But because you do that, when I do that, it's like a push and pull. Again, it's about relationship. It's about relationship between me and the canvas and what I'm after. And
it gives it that dimensional feel.
With the layering, and so a couple of these pieces of the series that you're talking about, which is the pink, as you were talking about, there are just translucent figures inside of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as though you had drawn attention to the shape of something, but not so much, you didn't deepen the colors in order to draw any more attention to it than the fact that it's simply there.
Right. It just sort of exists, but in a sort of a world that doesn't... I mean, because not everything in our world is, you know, just... it's not absolute. You know, our world is very...
We focus on things.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, it's open to interpretation.
We can't focus on everything.
Yeah, I mean, we're fluid in a sense that, you know, I mean, we may hold one ideology right now, but then a couple of... glasses of wine.
We are habitually incorrect.
Yeah, fluid,
I will admit that.
Something like that. So anyway, but also
a couple of glasses of wine. And yeah. I see Napoleon there, the right one.
But a lot of people a lot of my collectors are actually looking now for that hidden sort of thing, because I also do a lot of hiding of things in my work, because again, you know, I believe that we are who we are on the outside, and then there's so much to us, so much more depth to each one of us, that and it's in there's stuff that we never really
so you're
get
in,
out.
You're into the slow people movement, too.
I absolutely
am. I mean, in a way, which is tying in again to what, let's say my angst, it's not my fear, but my angst about the virtual world that we're so quickly being confronted with. Confronted maybe is not fair, but we're certainly, it's there. This requires you to stop and see and contemplate and confront it and engage with it. And hopefully, if it's your piece that you buy, you're going to do that throughout the lifetime of you owning it, and it's always going to be evolving as you do. I mean, that's the magic, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think secretly, I guess I hope that if people aren't spending any time outdoors or in nature, that they actually look at a piece of mine and they might want to get more in tune or in touch with that.
Yeah, not the most nature-loving city either, so they could use as much as they can get.
Exactly, exactly.
And
well, or maybe we love it more because it's so rare here.
Well, and that's another point, though, is that that's the reason that it's up on a wall in a gallery as opposed to on the internet. I mean, you sort of say it as though...
me hope.
You say it as though it's, quick information, quick entertainment is sort of setting a standard for art, but it might actually... they sort of set the standard for each other, or maybe they just exist separately, entirely.
We've talked about some of the sculpture, but you have other artists here. How before you describe some of the other art here and the artist... how did you know to put these particular artists up? How do you get the aha moment that that's somebody you want in your gallery?
Well, it's a series of things. I either see the art somewhere and I have a positive response to it.
First you have to like it.
I do have to like it, and I have to feel that there's some sort of sense. I generally won't show like violent art. I'm not really into blood and guts or anything.
Yeah, you've never
like
made
that.
An ugly piece. You've never made.
But
anything.
I mean, I wouldn't really want to show an artist that had that sort of, part to that person either. I'm not sure.
Like a cow foot and cut into five pieces.
Yeah, I mean, not somebody. I'm not really into angry art.
He always bothers those people because they're really going for controversy. They're going for just shocking the hell out of you so that you don't notice that their art sucks. But
yeah.
Well, there's the critic in you.
Well, no, you go see that sometimes. And we went and saw this artist one time, and that's exactly what he was going for. He was just throwing everything he could think of at it. He was trying as hard as he could to just amass so many different pieces of imagery and so many stark objects that you just to distract the hell out of you.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that's why, I mean, this particular artwork that you do is very dangerous because you don't have as much distraction. You don't have as much junk food or candy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be
different. So why is it dangerous? That's interesting.
It's dangerous because it has enough simplicity that you better be damn sure that what little you have on there is good.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so
would you agree with that?
Yeah. I would definitely say that
subversive.
A frugality to the way I apply paint, definitely. And I do want it to be sort of simplistic
like how many of these artists approached you, or how many of these artists did you approach to say
I approached them all.
What do you say to somebody?
I like your art.
Would you like to be hanging in my gallery?
Well, I mean, for an artist, isn't that... That's all artists hope for that.
Yeah. Yes,
right?
They do. Yes, they do. But, I mean, all the art in here I have right now... all the artists I respond to, I've seen... I mean, I do go on, tours of art and see other artists, or someone will recommend somebody and then I'll look at it and I'll think, this has a cohesiveness to, and when I do a show, I like to have like a kind of a cohesiveness to the show. And
for instance,
this show is called Organica, and this is all about this very like organic feeling of, nature. There's a lot of nature things here.
The sculpture is very organic. It's,
yes.
It's you could put your hands on it. It'd feel like a, or look like driftwood in some cases, but it's there are no sharp lines. There's no syntheticness to it.
Exactly. And then and then the iris inking. This is done painted with the ink of the iris flower. So that's definitely very organic.
That's a wonderful way you've got that displayed in gold framing, and you've got 12 or so frames of various representations of this artist working in the green ink.
It's very meditative. And
and you have to spend time with it. You can't just pass it by.
Right, and you should spend time with it because each one is interesting into itself. And then that's Adrian Rosenberg. Adrian Rosenberg that does the iris inking. And I actually became familiar with her work because she was at an artist show at the Contemporary. So I responded to it and, you know, got in touch with her. And then Fanny Brito is a painter who is dealing mostly with abstracts, but she's doing a lot of layering. But she's also a psychologist and uses art as therapy and for herself and others. And all of her work has to do with medical terminology at, in the beginning existence of a person. And so there's a lot of words and expression that's layered deeply within the canvas. And so I respond to that form.
And
too.
It is very intriguing. And when our listeners come to see this, I was really spellbound by it because you can see it as very engaging color that grabs your interest. But as you get closer and you examine it, you realize there's a narrative going on there, and there's a backstory, and you're allowed to follow it. You mm-hmm. might not figure it out, but that
right.
isn't the point.
Yeah.
You're intrigued to have to examine further.
And I get the distinct feeling that if I was to ask them, they'd be able to explain it to me, which is usually a very important thing for me as far
they
as an
would,
artist
they
is
would. And they would. And also, like she was saying, that she hopes that if somebody were to take that, like, infrared camera or whatever, that you can see underneath things, you know, they would find even more things underneath there that would be very telling, you know, that might be even...
Like that machine at the airport?
Secrets hidden in, down deep in the...
That would be pretty wicked, though. I mean, if you mm-hmm. purposefully painted over things with the express interest of people one day looking underneath...
That's what she's doing.
Oh,
you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, I like
mm-hmm.
that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Course,
and there you are.
Those psychologists, you know.
But you're transcending your
they're
time.
Damn paintings.
I mean, there's something about you say, well, digital is the way things are going. How intriguing can that be? Because that transcends time
right.
with something like that. And here you are dealing in brick-and-mortar life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for brick-and-mortar life.
Have you
figured that out?
Well,
that's
I mean,
where
I'm all for tactile. Yeah. I'm a touchy-feely. Yeah, definitely. Mm. Definitely. Yeah.
But I guess... But there is sort of that same complexity, you would say, to this. I mean, what if somebody took an infrared camera and went after one of these?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of...
Which is very, I mean, because it's very light. Now, actually, you have a larger piece in the front foyer, which is a lot of darkness. Actually, it's one of the best things I've ever seen.
Describe that piece, because it takes up an entire wall. It's just a huge... You're talking about
the leaves.
The
leafscape.
Yeah, but it's called Poetry of the Trees because I also am very interested in poetry. And so to me, leaves and trees, they offer a certain type of poetry in motion kind of... if that makes any sense.
Yes, and nearing the end of this, I should say, first of all, that you are actually a very skilled painter as opposed to being a very a well-directed or as far as a well-expressed painter.
Thank you.
It just looks great. I mean, it really just is a beautiful painting.
There is a difference, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, yeah, there's definitely
leave
a difference.
Jackson Pollock out of this.
Yeah, well, no, I'm more like... Bob Ross. Or,
well, okay.
You know.
Maybe so.
Or what you go, if you go to the Trade Center. I mean, yeah, sure, you can see. And that's also the danger of painting a lot of nature,
yeah.
is that you could get lumped in with that. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. you don't have a farmhouse.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that is it is a difficult thing to accomplish. It's a difficult thing to get right.
In your series.
Or at least in a way that's distinctive.
Yeah.
In some of the series that you'll do, this example here of the three in a row, Do you sell as a series, or will you break those children up? Will they go to different foster homes?
Those could be bought as one or sold separately. Yeah.
How do you feel about that, though, when they are separated?
I'm okay with that. Yeah, I mean, they were painted that way. They were painted that way with that intention.
Well, again, if you went to different places in a city, if you went to different homes or whatnot, and you saw sort of, I mean, it would be nice to have like four or five different pieces split up between different homes. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to see the rest of these, you'd have to go here or there.
Right.
Yeah. And it's like a scavenger hunter.
Intriguing idea, yeah. But there's a piece in the front room there that is six pieces that are meant to be one. So you know, I oftentimes will do multiples of.
If I just buy one of these, can you cut me a deal? Is that what somebody tries to say?
You know, I'm going to venture this opinion here, and I'm sure you'll agree. You're very lucky to have your husband Alberto involved. In what he's involved with, you two make a very good team for this, don't you? Because
yes,
it's so involved in the business aspect, the promotion aspect, the showing aspect, the publicity aspect, and then, of course, the art and studio and all of that. And he's with you all the way on that, isn't he?
Yes, and it's very, very good and very supportive. He's got the graphics, and he understands the computer, which... You know, I really don't have a lot of desire to get heavily involved in the computer aspects of the business.
I'm with you.
Which is unfortunate.
That's what he does.
You need it.
Well, then you need to get yourself a lovely wife that isn't those things. But, you know, I could totally understand that.
Yeah, it's nice. He brings a lot of other things to the table. But there's a couple of things. I mean, how much more time do we have?
Five, six more minutes.
There's couple of things I want to touch on. One is that I've had just enough, I have just enough chutzpah to be able to talk about myself easily. I'm not a shy artist. I'm not a shrinking violet. I don't mind going up to a person and saying, you know, are you interested in that piece? And I can make it happen for you. You know, I'm good at marketing myself, or I'm not shy about that.
Do you find many artists...
I would say that most of them are, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I just think that...
Has Alberto helped you in that, or is that a part of your characteristic?
No, I was just always sort of out there, you know. Yeah. My parents had a great deal to do with it, I guess. So I have just enough gumption. And my husband also is very gregarious and friendly, and so that makes... us a good team and interesting in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think art can be sort of introspective or introverted, so a lot of people are very introverted and they don't really know how to talk about their work, and especially when it comes to buying their work, it's like they start to freak out or whatever. And
what's the main advice you would give a collector who might be listening to this? Is it first and foremost the quality of the investment or the love of the piece that you're buying?
I say it's the love of the piece, but that's totally...
That's a very romantic thing for you to say.
Yes, exactly. It's totally a heart.
It's very ideal.
Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, one thing we really haven't touched on quite enough, and it's really the biggest conundrum of all, is that, and the frustration for a gallery owner... is that, you know, you want people to love your art, but that doesn't pay the bills. I mean, you know, I've got plenty of people coming in here and telling me what a beautiful space this is, how nice I am, or how nice my husband is, or, you know, what a beautiful painting that is. And unless they fork over some cash, it's like, well, I might not be here.
Well, love is free, Mary. Originally, it is.
It is, and that's what I'm betting on. But you know, there's many sweaty, you know, sleepless nights over. You know, just being able to, you just want that. I mean, I'm not like asking for a huge fame. You just want it to be able to play. in the sandbox.
Well, all the while trying to figure out how to achieve that without compromising
yourself.
Well,
let's be honest.
Because you could do some things. You could do some cop-out, sell-out things to your artwork.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's be honest here, though. I mean, America,
I'm not making
as opposed to so much of the rest of the world, certainly European countries are so good at investing in artists and art. And,
yeah.
And we consider artists independent contractors, and yeah. you're kind of on your own.
But why is that? Why,
well, why is that?
I mean, I would like to know.
I have a theory that our country was founded by people who pretty entrepreneurial. You had to have some gumption and some discomfort with where you were to go to all the trouble to make it over here. And that whole ethic of seeing what's on the other side of the hill and striving for the new life and your own way of interpreting your life and all that kind of stuff, I think it's permeated a lot even in our aesthetic lives.
And I think that we have a very simplistic way of looking at things in which when you do work, that you have to come up with a widget or a bale of cotton or something like a package of something. It has to be a literal end result. It cannot be, there is nothing at all ethereal about it, I mean, to them. I mean, it has to be something very specific, and it has to be pretty much the same every time.
Right.
If you set out to be a woodworker, you have to make a chair by the time it's over with, not something bizarre.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think people see art as being very flippant in that degree, is that when you are working, you don't know exactly what you're going to come out with. It could be good, could be bad, expressive, not specific to yourself, specific to others.
But look what happened after World War One, when the doughboys of America went over to Europe and they saw things for the first time, and they came back, and especially in New York and Philadelphia and other places, they started doing some things that they saw and started inventing
museums
on their own.
And can you imagine the places smaller than New York City where that was stamped out entirely? You know, where they had gone back, and, you know, you go back to Podunk, Oklahoma. I mean, you try to tell people about that, they're not
really
going to give a damn. In fact, they'll be intimidated by it.
But it rarely
it.
Starts like, in a Podunk.
You know,
I mean, it does.
Fire for the
We
warlocks.
Have to have those centers. I mean, that's always been the case. I mean,
yeah. But I mean, but
Florence was the center.
Imagine a world without art, though. I mean, it's like that's our connectivity of all of the of our history and everything. I mean, that's how we connect.
But don't we
with the rest of the
we commodify
universe.
It differently than maybe Europeans do.
And we don't take for granted that it'll always be there. I mean, that's the reason why y'all are expressing concern at all. Is I think a lot of people disregard art because they feel as though it's something, a commodity that'll always be available to them, and that they won't have to actually look hard for it. Which is kind of true now. I mean, not
that's an interesting point. Yeah.
It is actually kind of true. I mean, now everybody's an artist, and now there's an art show every week.
When people come here, they think that to themselves, oh, well, this art gallery will be there. I don't have to buy anything. I mean, this art gallery will be here. Art galleries are always around.
Yeah.
They're not
yeah.
thinking about the individual owners of galleries
exactly.
that
well,
are going
not.
Out of business.
Let's dispel people who might be listening who aren't aesthetics themselves, but curious about it. Being an artist is not a casual expenditure in your life.
Right.
It takes a pretty big commitment.
It does.
A pretty big commitment of time and effort and long-term effort.
Absolutely.
Why is that so misunderstood?
I don't know.
It seems to me it is.
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, back to our many levels, you know, I mean, there's many levels of art. And maybe you're not, if you're not recognized by the certain persons or that are going to recognize you, you may not ever get recognized on the larger scale. Why is that? You know, I mean, I think probably we'll end this interview with more questions than actually answers, because there is
we love that.
There is a lot of things missing from the equation, and the equation is, you know, you have to sell your art to make more art, because you don't want to just store it up into, you know, a vast storage unit. You want to sell more. You want so you can make more, and the story keeps on evolving. And so really there's really art for every taste or everyone, and it should be accessible. And I would say to any listener that doesn't understand art, ask questions and make sure that you understand, or, you know, try to understand. And if you respond to a piece of art, don't let it bother you that it may that artist may not have a name yet, or I don't know. Just respond.
You know, there's also an interesting thing that one of my professors years ago brought up, and at first I repelled against it, and over the period of my life I've understood it much better, and that is confronting and engaging with art doesn't always result in a pleasure. It can actually be discomforting.
Absolutely.
And be quite valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think more than anything, it's overwhelming and intimidating. I mean, art in general, that's why people aren't going to respond to it as easily. I mean, why do you think dogs playing poker was such a success? You know, I mean, because people were expecting, like, of course, you know, owning a gallery is rather like owning a restaurant. You'd better love doing it, or otherwise you're a fool.
Yeah.
And but even with a restaurant, I mean, you are expecting a specific thing. If you order... I don't know, fettuccine Alfredo, you're expecting fettuccine and Alfredo sauce and not some grand, bizarre variation of it to intimidate the hell out of you.
Right, right, exactly.
You are expecting a pretty damn standard meal.
But that element of surprise, or being willing to be surprised, which is what maybe would be the optimum thing you'd want somebody to come to any piece of art with, is willingness to be confronted with it and see what happens.
Right. Well, and also that brings up another point, is that no one wants to appear foolish. So, like, if you really respond to an art or an art piece, and then you have it on your wall, and somebody comes up and looks at it and laughs, or says, "What'd you see in that?" Then, you know, I mean, basically you're wearing your feelings on your wall, I suppose.
But it could be a teaching moment, couldn't it?
It could be.
That's what I mean, maybe they're hoping. Right.
Well, it could be.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah. Well.
So,
and I don't know why bad art seems to do better than good.
Well, I know, really. You stick a Virgin Mary in the middle of that, it'll be gone tomorrow.
What,
you don't see that often.
I'm going to hold you to that. What is bad art?
A bad art is art without a soul. And I think there is art without a soul. I think art, I mean, there's a place here that factory sort of produced art, or art that doesn't really think outside of the box. I mean, how oftentimes have you gone to the dentist's office and you've seen the little cypress trees, and, you know, all in a row, and they're, you know, some Italian landscape or whatever.
It came with the frame.
Exactly. And it's like,
there's like a barcode at the bottom right corner of it.
It's decorative.
Much? Yeah.
Which, you know, the barcodes, like, actually might be the most attractive part of it.
Yeah.
Because they do look pretty nice in the right context.
Yeah, they can.
But you've never regretted that with crayons and being a 5-year-old that you wanted to be living the life of an artist? You've never regretted it, have you?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, it ties together all of the parts that are important to me: my spiritual, my physical, my sensuality, my feeling about mankind, everything. It just, it's all encompassing, and it worries me, because I don't know that I could do anything else. Like I said, I can't go into nursing.
Well, for RJ, I know, and myself, we don't want you to do anything else. You've been so sweet to let us come to your gallery, and we love what you do.
Thank you.
We're glad that you could talk to us about it.
Yeah, thank you much, Mary.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck in your gallery, too.
Thank you.